Hello and welcome back to the Sunday podcast. I'm Ollie Lum, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Seddon. This week we spoke to 800 metre runner, Elliot Giles. Elliot's got a PB of 1:43, he's the British number one, and he's just back from Tokyo. Enjoy.
Welcome back, guys, to cure your Olympic hangover. As Lum says, we got the big man, Elliot Giles, Britain's best 800 metre runner, probably currently. Cracking episode. Look, one thing which stood out for me, we chat a lot about sort of Giles' mindset and how he's developed that mindset over time. Obviously, we discuss, you know, rebuilding after the bike crash. But more importantly, we discuss his racing brain right now, because he is someone who's an incredible racer. He's pretty much every race he does, he's getting amongst, you know, winning second, third on the circuit. And then we also talk about how, you know, he battled at the Olympic Games and how he reflects on that performance and how he's going to move forward from here as well. And then we talk about, you know, his side hustle, his hobbies outside of running as well, and how he believes it's essential to, you know, set up an income which isn't dependent on contracts, because the pressure of, you know, continuing to perform with contracts and funding and stuff like that is only going to be detrimental to your performance in the long run. So he can go into races, you know, with another source of income, you know, with the business he's set up, and not have to worry about that at races. He can almost race free, if you like, and not have to worry about, you know, making money on the circuit. And if he doesn't win a certain race, his contract getting, you know, halved or reduced at any point. So some super interesting stuff. You know, his achievements, his accolades, they speak for himself. Enjoy the podcast. Get out for your long run. And we've got some great guests lined up over the next few weeks as well. So stay tuned.
Right. Hi, Elliot. First of all, just welcome to the podcast and congrats on, you're now a two-time Olympian. If you had some time to reflect on it now, you're home, obviously.
Not really. I haven't even watched a race, if I'm honest. I've just sort of chilled out and just getting on with it, seeing the season as it's still moving forward.
No, mate, that's interesting that you say that, because I think, you know, there was almost two types of athlete, you know, after Tokyo, isn't there? After a big competition, there's either the ones who call it a day for the season and sort of revalidate, or the ones who are just hungry to sort of get after it again.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's easy to say it now. I saw myself in that final as the bare minimum. I sort of ticked every box leading up to it, and I majorly didn't quite pull off what I thought I could have, which was the minimum being in the final. So yeah, I mean, but to be honest, I think for a lot of athletes, they put a lot emotionally into it, so that when the big competition is done, it's like a big, like, you know, and you can just take a big breath and then you sort of chill out a bit. Whereas I kind of don't really put any emotions into it. I kind of just run racing like I'm training. So I don't really get worn out or anything, which is why I'm still racing. And I'll pretty much race until there's no more races left, because I don't feel burnt out or even tired, or I don't feel ready to stop yet, put it that way.
Yeah, wow. With that then, do you get a chance to kind of enjoy the games as a games, or is it kind of strictly business, I guess?
No, I just run it as like I've got to a point now where I'm just not really nervous before races. So I'm having to like psych myself up a bit more, because I had to pinch myself a little bit in the semis and remind myself that I'm at the Olympics. It doesn't affect my performance. If anything, it probably helps it, because I'm so chilled out. But I just saw it as I've done all year. I spend a lot of time away. I train and I race, and I sort of just roll with it.
Yeah, well, I guess that mentality helps massively, because you're not afraid to fail in that sense. You know, you, whatever the result is, you'll move forward.
That's it. That was my view, which is why, like, British champs and stuff. This year, it's the least nervous I've probably ever been, because in my head, I just told myself before British champs, I said, I'm going to run the race like I'm running it for the second time. And I know how I can win it. And I just tried to execute it that way. It's a bit like what I did at the Olympics. I knew how I could win the race. I knew the people in my race. And I executed the plan to a T. What I intended to do was just the last 50 meters. I just didn't have any legs to hold the boys off. So it is what it is. I mean, we're talking about the Olympics. Only 8 guys in the world can tell that start line. Not everyone's destined to be in that final. And you just got to keep rolling with it. And if I take it as a loss and I dwell on it, then I might miss my opportunity. That might be coming up in a few weeks, where I might win a few races or run a few quick times. So I'm hungry, man. I'm always hungry.
Yeah, I think you're bang on. Did you watch the final?
I did. I was gutted, man. I was gutted.
When I watched it, I was like, man, that looked like a good race for you to be in, because the way you've been running your races this season, the way you've been winning races has been like off of like not, I guess, tactical races. You know, you've been able to, you've been able to change pace, basically.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree. I agree. But I saw it and I did think that, and I thought, but the reality is I could have been in that final. It's just me that stopped myself being in there. So it's all coulders, wouldas, shouldas. I want to make amends for it and just keep doing what I'm doing, and hopefully one day. But the thing is, you have to understand as well, and all athletes have to understand it, that we're not guaranteed to ever taste that glory. We're not guaranteed to win a gold medal. We're not guaranteed to sign a big contract. We're not guaranteed to win a race. Nothing's guaranteed in our sport. The start line doesn't discriminate. It doesn't care how hard you've worked, how much you think you deserve it. All you've got to keep doing is keep busting your balls and keep trying and pushing, chipping away. And you might taste success, but as long as you're content with the idea that you've done all you can, and I'm content with the idea that I might not get to where I want to be, but I'm still going to keep trying. And if I get there, great. If I don't, I'm happy either way. So that's, and I guess that mindset kind of takes the pressure on the edge of it a little bit, because I'm kind of just have the mindset of what will be. I can just put myself in a position to try and perform as and when I can.
Yeah. Wow. On that sort of mindset though, obviously, like, you've got to prepare well to be able to have that mindset. So how kind of were your preparations leading into Tokyo?
Oh, mate, I was in shape. I was whacking out some big boy sessions. I was doing everything that I was supposed to be doing. And yeah, I kind of had like an underlying confidence that I was going to run well. I think even my coach thought at the bare minimum I would be in the final. And then it was just navigating the final. Because you know what the 8's like, it's all to play for. There's,
well, yeah,
the winner doesn't necessarily win in the 800, which is why you don't get, besides Radisha, you don't get consistent. You don't get a consistent man at the top that reigns. And it's that's just the way it's been pretty much from the start of time in the 800. It's so unpredictable. That's why, I guess, if you go back to London 2017, not one guy from London 2017 made the final in 2019. And I don't think there's a single event that has that kind of volatile environment where, like, the majority of the final in the Olympics was probably very different to world champs in 2019. So it's very up and down, and that's why there's all to play for. And it's probably actually harder to get to the final than it is to medal in the 800. That's my own opinion.
Yeah, I think everyone would agree with that. We've always said it as well. You know, it's harder to make a final just because of the qualification,
yeah,
rounds. And like you said, no finals are the same really at all.
Never. We go back to the last Olympics and Radisha run it in. Did he run it? I think he won it in 142 low, I think.
Yeah.
142 low or 141 high. And then we go back to this one here and it's won in 145.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, that's a big difference. Talking free.
Different style of racing, you know, yeah, everything, mate. Mate, when you were out in Tokyo, like, sounds like you just kind of treated it, well, you've already said you did treat it like a normal race and you just went out there to race and do business. Did it help, obviously, being to Rio? You weren't fazed by sort of getting the Olympic experience, if you like?
Oh, no, Rio, I was out of my depth. I was scared at Rio. I wasn't prepared for it. And I was, like, nervous on the start line. I was overwhelmed by the whole experience. I think Rio was a whole different ballgame. I didn't go to Rio expecting to be able to be a contender. Whereas, I guess, I had an element of myself at this one here where I believe that I could and should be a contender. So I went into it. Rio was like a whole different, almost like lifetime compared to where I am now, pretty much. But yeah, so that was a completely different experience.
Yeah, I'm all mean, like, so when you were in Tokyo, you were just preparing for the races, basically. You weren't worried about enjoying the Olympic experiences in, like, the village and all the, you know, all the side things which come with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was limited in a sense that there wasn't much to do. I pretty much just do what I do at home. I don't really change anything up. And when I'm at home, I normally just chill out and just get on with what I'm doing. In the meantime, there wasn't really much to do in at the Olympics, in all honesty. There wasn't, I mean, besides chilling out with the lads that you normally do on the circuit, there wasn't really that much on to offer. So I guess I just treated it as I do everything else. I'd normally sort of spend a lot of time by myself, if you like. And then I would just eat with the guys in my apartment and stuff like that and just sort of got on with it like I would on a circuit. So I didn't treat it like it was an Olympic Games. I didn't change anything. I didn't train any harder. If anything, I trained slightly less than I normally would, and pretty much just treated it like I would have been on the circuit, like I have done the majority of the year, and like I will do in the next few weeks.
Yeah. It's such an interesting way to look at it. But obviously, you've already alluded to it there. It's not always been the case with Rio. So like, we'd like to just kind of rewind a bit and go back. So I think 2015 was after you had some time off from the sport. Do you mind just like going through with our listeners? I think it's been well documented before, just about, I think you had a motorbike accident. Is that right?
I've spoken about that a few times now. In the long and short, I was knocked off. It messed me up for a little while. But prior to that, I was injured for like 3 years, but the motorbike accident probably actually kickstarted me into being a half decent athlete, because I kind of slowed things down, and rather than rushing back into training, I had to do it step by step, and walking became running, jogging became light sessions became running, and then running became racing over the space of about 6 to 8 months. So it was lengthy, it was tough, it was a dark place. My body was a bit of a mess. I was wedged in between the car and the bike. I landed on the curb and hit my head off a bollard. I was knocked out, dealt with brain damage for a few years. And yeah, it was a dark place. But I mean, I guess that's probably what shaped me to where I am now. But again, I haven't really achieved anything yet. So I say it shaped me. It's shaping me into what I think I can become. But I just need to do it now.
Did you see like a mindset or anything change before or after the accident at all? Like, was your outlook on life different? Was your outlook on running different?
Man, I whacked my head hard. I don't know. I whacked my head pretty hard. To be honest, I lost myself for a little bit. I kind of forgot who I was, and a lot of character traits changed with me, and I was confused for a long time. And it's taken me quite a few years to kind of get back and realize who and what I am. If that makes any sense. It probably doesn't, because it didn't to me at the time. But looking back, I knew that I was pretty messed up, and because I was away from home and I didn't really have any friends nearby that. Because I was based at St. Mary's, and all of my family and long-term friends were based in Birmingham and stuff. So it was it was difficult at the time, but I guess if you've gone through anything like that, you don't really know what you're going through until you kind of come out the other end and you look back, and then it's like an oh shit moment. But yeah, I guess it did change me in that sense.
Yeah, that's interesting. What part of you kind of wanted to carry on running? Because I guess a lot of people, like you say, like if you're injured for 3 years and then have that as well, what was it that made you want to like go back to the sport, I guess?
I don't know. I you know, it's funny. You know, back then I think I was 18 or 19 years old. My PB for the 8 was like 1:53, but I still had this dumb, dogged desire that I could be the best. And I mean, my PB was 1:53, and I had the audacity to think that I could be contender with the guys running 10 seconds quicker. Well, in fact, 12 to 13 seconds quicker. I don't know. I just believed that I could do it. And I figured if they can do it, then there's no reason I can't do it. And I mean, I'm still 2 seconds off, a second off the top guys this year. But I'm a damn sight closer than I was anyway. But I guess just an inner belief that you could be there, and then chipping away for years and years. And when you've been injured for like 3 years and you miss a track season for 3 years and then you have a big motorbike accident, you kind of think it never crossed my mind that it'd be over. But yeah, I get dumb enough to stick to the sport and keep believing, and I guess I'm reaping small rewards.
Yeah, I mean, this may sound like a stupid question, but like, where does the belief come from? Like, did you have someone in your corner growing up who kind of like, you know, pushed you into the sport, or did you find the sport yourself? Like, where does that belief come from?
I think a lot of things are just ingrained, aren't they? If you some kids kind of want to be good, some kids are sort of content just being mediocre, but have the potential to be the best, and some kids just aren't interested, and they've got all the talent in the world. And I guess I just believe that I could be a contender. I don't know where it came from. I don't know what shaped it. I guess elements of my upbringing and always being sampling all sorts of sports and stuff. And I don't know. I don't know. I can't really answer that question. Too tough there.
Yeah. How did you get into running then to start with?
I mean, I just got bored of playing sports at school pretty much. I was sampling pretty much every sport you can think of, from rugby to football to Gaelic football. Mm-hmm. I was sailing at one point, like an inner city boy from Birmingham sailing. I grew up in a rough area as well. So me sailing was a big thing back then. I remember I was leaving school at 16, just before leaving, I went down to Betchford Harriers at Alexander Stadium. And I just asked them if I could, long story short, I said, can I join the club and stuff? After a few back and forths, my coach, my first coach, Eddie Cocaine at the time, agreed to take me on. And it sort of just spiraled from there pretty much. And
wow,
it was either 12 or 18 months later, I got my first England vest. So that kind of sparked the desire. But then when I got my first call up for my England vest, I had a stress fracture. and I was running with a stress E in my tibia for like 2 months. But of course, you get your first England vest and you're running it regardless. And that's where the injuries sort of started, because I ran for like a year and a half and then spent three years on the sideline, and then the bike crash, and then things sort of took off. So I guess I would have featured through the junior champs had I not had all the issues of injuries and stuff. But because I was always injured, I was never able to even make a dent in the juniors and stuff.
Mate, firstly, I mean, that's fascinating that you kind of found the sport yourself, because I think that's so rare, especially in running. You either do it because you've got connections, or maybe a PE teacher or friends push you into, but you kind of went out and kind of found running yourself. But then secondly, do you think that's helped you long-term not featuring in junior champs as a kid as much?
100%. I can say that now looking back, I think so. But I guess because I was always like, when I played football, I was always like, everyone used to call me the workhorse, because I was never the best player, but I had a better engine than anyone. I'd always outwork someone, but I would never outscale them. I guess that's what started it off with the running, because I knew I could run. So I figured I may as well channel my energy there. And then things sort of went from there. And sorry, what was the other question?
No, I was kind of just saying, like, you know, I think it's impressive. No, do you think that helped you benefit not doing junior champs, basically?
I don't know. Do you know what? It's funny, because I was watching some of the guys that, like, Ali Dustin and Max Bergen.
Of course, yeah.
And I was saying that they're running 10 seconds quicker than I was at their age. Like, 10 seconds is insane. When you think about it, it's an insane amount. And that's why I just think that their future, I'm really intrigued to see how they progress as athletes, because they're already considered at the top.
Yeah.
And they're not even 20 years old yet. So I'm intrigued to see how they sort of continue on, because it's impossible for them to keep PBing every year. If you're already running 143 and 144,
you're not going to be running 135.
You're not running 135. You see where I'm going? So I'm intrigued to see. So I'd be I'm excited to see if they aim to win medals and win races as opposed to try and run quick, because I think that would be the smart move. But I think not doing junior champs, I guess it just meant that I didn't get bored of the sport like I did every other sport, pretty much. I probably would have got bored of running if I did do the junior champs, because I got bored of everything else I played. So that could be the long and short of it.
Did you, I mean, this year especially, obviously you had like Dustin running 143. I think you were in his race when he ran 143, weren't you?
Oh, mate, I blew a gasket.
But like, did you feel extra pressure, you know, from these guys coming up? I mean, it sounds like you didn't, to be fair, but, you know.
Mate, if I'm being honest with you, that race with Dustin was in, I came back from a quad tear, and I didn't think I was going to be in shape the week before. And I ran in Henglow after only being back for a week, because I had 3 weeks out. And I was running kind of scared a little bit, but I ran half decent in Henglow. And then I went and ran in Marseille, and I ran 3:33 for the 15, which even me and my coach sat down afterwards, and we were both like, I don't know how the hell I've just done that. Because I missed so much training prior to it. I'm not training for the 1500. I'm training for the 8. Like, my mileage is pathetic. Like, I'm only pinging out sort of 15, 20 mile a week, plus the cross training work. And it didn't make any sense how I could physically run 3:33. So I went into Nice with this like supreme confidence, and I was like, I said I was going to run 143 low there. So that was my plan. So I raced Nice, and I went out in 49. I went through in 49 for the first four, and I went through in about 116 low, and I blew a gasket. the last 200, I think I ran like a 29 or something, which is slower than the under bloody 13s would run, pretty much. And which is why when you see that race, you'll see that it's quite misleading, because I ran a 29 last 200, whereas Ali probably ran like a 26. Mm. But it looks like Ali drops like a 23 or 22 last 200. And he looks like he's... But you had... I just blew a gasket so bad that... he still ran 143.8 or 6, which is absolutely mind-boggling for his age. And it was a hell of an achievement. But it's made even more impressive by how badly I bloody died. And it was embarrassing watching it back. But if I'm honest, I didn't really factor in anyone else in that race. In my head, I went into that race and just figured it was a catch me if you can kind of thing. And I believed, because I ran 1:33, I thought I'd be able to hold on to it.
Mm.
But the reality was 49 was too quick. 116 low hurt a lot. And the last 200, bloody, that was it.
But having the confidence to mix up races and do races, like, you know, take a different approach to each race, surely helps you long term, right?
Oh, massively. Yeah, you got to be, you know, the thing is that like, most people are scared to race against each other.
Yes.
In my head, I'm just like, if I'm honest, I don't care who I'm racing against. I don't care if you're going to, if my tactic is to try and run hard from the front, I'm running hard from the front. My tactics to sit in, I'm sitting in. If my tactics to be in the pack, I'm being in the pack. Regardless who's in it, you're going to race them at some point. So if you're shying away or being scared about them, then you've kind of lost the race before you've even started. Even if you're a better athlete, me personally, I'm quite happy to race anyone, anywhere, sort of anytime kind of thing. I don't really believe in the whole not racing someone because they might beat you on head to heads and it could affect funding or training or races and all that nonsense. Just race, man. We do it every day. We train hard enough. We don't need to be scared to race each other.
Yeah. No, it's so interesting hearing your perspective on that. What's your thoughts on kind of racing for times and racing for wins? Because like one thing we've kind of noticed and we discussed before, like myself and Matt, is that how often you do actually win races, particularly when it comes to the big ones like your British champs, in terms of making teams and things. I think you've won, what, 5 or 6?
Yeah, I've won a few.
Indoors and outdoors. So how do you compare the two, like, I guess, between time trialing, I guess, and just racing for that position?
You see it, don't you? I mean, look at, in the most respectful way, like look at Amos in sort of Diamond Leagues.
Yep.
Kick everyone's ass every day, Diamond Leagues, bring it to a championship and the dynamic changes, the headspace changes. You take out the pacemaker and everything just goes out the window. So I guess that does show you the difference. Do you want to be a championship racer or do you want to be a time trialist? Mm-hmm. It's a fine balance. I mean, this year, like the way I've been running, you could argue that I've been edging more towards like a calculated time trialer, like a tactical time trialer, because I'm running lots of races back to back. I'm running sort of decent times consistently, but I mean, I'm not necessarily running them tactically as such. I can run a tactical race, but I guess my aim this year was always to. So our plan was always to run 144 high in the heats if needed, to be ready to run 45 mid, but be ready in the heats, potentially 45 low, which is what normally the heats are happening in the Olympics. Then it was to run a 44 low in the semis. And if I had to lead it out, I was prepared to do that. And then the final was about trying to run a 143. And that's what we planned to do. But of course, my heats, I bloody ran a 44 low, whatever it is. And I did, if I'm honest, I did not see that coming. I couldn't believe how quick that heats was. I've never known a heats go that quick. And I remember in the race thinking that this is quick. And then the following day, of course, the plan was to run a 44 low. And I knew that would get me in the final. But I tried to run at 44 low. I took it from the start. But I guess the difference is when you actually lead a race literally from the start without a pacemaker, because I was at the front from the get-go, it's very different to having someone help you for the first 400. And I guess that's what played dividends, and not dividends, but that's what went against me in the last 50 in the old race. And that's probably what cost me, because my plan was to do what I did. But I don't know if maybe the 44 the day before just caught me out a little bit more than I thought it would, or maybe my tactics were worse, because I could have sat in my semi-final, but then I didn't want to risk sitting in with the likes of Isaiah Jewett, Amos, Tuka, and Roltich, because when, I mean, my semi-final we had world ranked number 2, world ranked number 3, and world ranked number 5, so, and that doesn't even include Amos, who wasn't ranked, he's not ranked this year. So when you look on paper and you look at my semi, I was like, wait, my semi could very well have been majority of the final. And then when you look at the other semis, I was like, wait, these numbers don't correlate. You wouldn't put number 2, 3, 5 and then Jewett, who's not considered ranked, and Amos, who's not considered ranked. The seeding didn't make sense, which is why I made a calculated decision. I tried to run the legs off the boys. And because I ran the 3:52 mile in a Gateshead just prior to it, I believe that I was the strongest in the race. So I tried to run the legs off the boys. I thought 2 days back to back, I'm the strongest in the race. Let's take it on kind of thing. But it didn't work out for one reason or another. But I'll be stronger next year and I'll be ready to do the same again. And hopefully we get this now.
I think you hit it on the head. I mean, that time Roltich ran and your time as well must have been well up there. It was the fastest run outside of a final ever in the Olympic Games.
I remember being in that race and watching all the boys and thinking, what the hell are they doing? Like, quick. Like, it was quick. Yeah. I know how my body should feel at each point of the race. I know what hurts. I know when my body's going to fatigue. And I remember thinking, shit, these boys are running quick.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't know what our splits was or anything, but I do remember thinking this is too quick, which is why when Roltich and Bol ran off, I just remember, I said in my head, I'm not having none of this. I'm running for third place.
Yeah, right.
And I remember thinking, I've got a race again tomorrow, but And the flip side, Rotic was absolutely fine, and he smashed the semis, but he did sit in the whole way until 100 to go, which makes a difference.
You know, one thing I think is huge in 800 meter running, and you may second it, is like momentum. You know, like you say, when you're at the front of the field, the guys just on your shoulder or just in behind, they just get the momentum down the home straight, which you probably won't get.
I reckon there's a good 10% difference being able to sit on somebody's shoulder. 10 to 15% easy, because I don't know why it is. Leading from the front is a ridiculous amount harder than it is sitting on someone's shoulder. I don't know why. I don't know if it's because you can switch off and just chill and focus on rhythm and stuff. Whereas if you're at the front, you're constantly trying to surge and push on, which is a skill that I've tried to learn. And I've tried to learn how to run from the front comfortably. And I've got better at it. Hence why I still ran 44.7, I think, which isn't a bad time considering I ran from the front. And I mean, but next year I want to be in a position where I can run 43 from the front without any assistance. So that's the aim, sort of moving into next year. And I want to know that I can do that at the click of a finger, which is why we've done so many races back to back leading up to the games, because I knew I had a 44 at the front in my locker. I did, but I don't know if a 43 is there. I've only ever run 43 once, and I haven't even done it outdoors yet. So that's definitely the next step up. And the goal this year was to be a consistent 44 runner. And I've done it probably 6 or 7 times already this year. I mean, I've still got a few more races left. So by the end of the year, I might have ran 44 or quicker, like 10 plus times by the end of the season, which isn't bad, to be fair. It's a good resume, but I need to get those consistent times down to 43s. And then if I can run 43s back to back, I can almost guarantee I'm going to be in that world final next year. And I know I'll be vying for a medal, because I know I can run 43 with my eyes closed. And that's going to be the aim, I think, for next year.
Yeah, I mean, how have you managed to get that consistency? Because I think you're bang on. I think consistency is the way to go. And then you just, you know, you make that next step next year and you start running more 143s and they turn into 142s and so on, man. But like, yeah, you've done an incredible amount, you know, 7 144s. You must have done a few 145s indoors as well. How have you managed to get that consistency so good, basically?
Just racing, just learning my craft. Like, I don't spend too much. We haven't trained that much this summer. So we've been doing a lot of races and stuff, and we've been prioritizing racing to learn our craft and to learn how to run and how it feels and the ins and outs and the motions of.
So yeah, so you can basically run 144 in numerous different ways now. As before, you may have had to bank on, you know, getting a good pace, just getting in a good race.
Yeah. So I've learned how to race in that sense. So I know that I can step on the start line and run 144 in a variety of different ways. Whereas before, it was like you said, I was banking on a pacemaker getting to me to a certain pace, and then it was just like, hold on. Whereas now I'm in that position where I can say, well, I can do it any way I want, pretty much. And I know how to do it, and I won't have to panic. But again, unless you're in the 143s and you can do that, you're not on the money. So that's what has to be the priority next year.
In all fairness, when you get in the 143s, you do that consistently, mate, you're just cleaning up almost every diamond you're going, aren't you?
You see where I'm going. Yeah, that's that will be the aim next year. But it will be doing that and knowing that if I've got somebody on my shoulder, I can hold them off, and it's just what I need to do, which is what I was able to do in a few of the races, but I messed up and one of the most important ones.
How kind of important do you think that, obviously the tactical side of things is so important at your level, but how important do you think that is kind of maybe in slower times or younger down in the rankings? Because we see a lot of coaches and younger athletes that kind of only focuses on fitness and being fitter and being more capable of running fast times, and maybe not so much on the ways in which you run it and navigating rounds and things like that.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what you favor. Like, even down to like training and stuff, I run small mileage, but then it's because I prioritize my sessions. So do you prioritize the quality work, or do you prioritize the fact that you can go and run 60, 70 plus mile a week? I would much rather, I'm in a position now where the last 2 years we run during track season, sort of 15 to 20 mile a week. And then in the winters, we'll go up to sort of between 20 and 30 mile a week. And then the rest of it is topped up by cross training. And then we just prioritize the sessions, because the sessions keep you closer to the race pace. And I'm never actually fatigued, which means that when my coach says to me, right, I want you to run a 50 second 400, you've got 30 seconds rest, I want that backed up with a 25 200 or something, I'm always in a position where I can just be like, cool, I'm not too fatigued to do that. Mm-hmm. So we can race plan and race prep. But if you're always constantly fatigued, you can't ever really practice the quality work, because your body's always in a deficit. And you just feel awful. And it's always, it's almost learning how that feels through each point. And because I allow myself to freshen up so much, it's probably why I know that I can run consistently. And I'm not winning all of my, I'm not winning my races. I'm a lot of them, I'm finishing second and third, but I'm usually in the top three consistently for the majority of my races. And I think it's largely because we prioritize sort of quality work, learning how to run paces and learning how I should feel at each point of the race, and just sort of believing in what we've been working on.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Do you find that just gives you more confidence throughout as well, like throughout the winter, throughout the season, you know, because you're running closer to race pace, you're just getting more confidence you can actually do it in the races. People who are far away from race pace for large majority of the winter, they're probably not as confident they're going to hit a certain time come summer.
Yeah, 100. I mean, winters, don't get me wrong, winters, I still do the grunt work. So like the other day I came back and we done 4 by a mile off a minute, and the mile reps were I'm still running quick for the mile reps. So if I done 4 by a mile, we done, our first one was 4:41, then 4:47, 4:41, 4:47 or something like that. So the times, I'm still running like good times for my, I can still do the good work. It's just that I'll do my warm up. I'll do that 4 by a mile. I'll do like an 800 meter core down, and then I cut it then, and that will, and then I won't run the next day, and I probably won't have run the day before. So it's, I guess, and then because I'm not running for a few days after that, I can come back to the track on the Saturday and I can do like the workout my coach sets me. So my coach said to me the other day, he wanted 600, 400, 300, 200. And the session was all about the six and the four. So the idea was to get into such a mess in the six, the four needed to be like, the four needed to feel like I couldn't finish, and then the 300 and the 200 needed to feel like I was contemplating life. Whereas I could have run that session and tried to run it like a good 600 split in like 117 maybe, or like and then like a four in like maybe 50, and then a three in maybe 36, and then maybe a two in 25. But that wasn't the idea. The idea was to make it messy so that I was in a bad place. So like I went through my first two in like, I think I went through 400 in about 47. And then it was, and I'm not typically a fast runner. So going through 47 for four and then carrying on for another 200 meters, you can imagine how I felt. So then I only came back in like a 1:15.2. And I think my last 100 was probably about 14 or 15 seconds or something like that.
Wow.
And I was in a crazy deficit. And then you get your recovery. And then the idea was that when my body was swimming, which is what I might feel like in a race, like my body was, I wasn't ready to run the 400. And then my coach is like, right, we want to get as close to 50 as possible. And then the idea is that like, if I can get as close to 50, impossible in training, the race is never going to feel as bad as that. And then I only ran like a 52 for the four, and then the 300 and the 200 aren't even worth speaking about. But the idea was that you're learning how to deal with like the deficit and the lactic through those periods. And I guess that's where me and my coach have sort of gone at it. Cause normally we do that session and we might run like a 116 high to 117. Then you'd run like a 50 flat, and then you'd run like a 38 to 39, and then you'd run a 25, 26. But I mean, we can all do that all day long, but what we don't know is, can we go into like the depths of how in trying to push your body further than it's meant to be pushed? And then can you hold on for that second lap, which might be closer to race simulation? Because I always say like, we can all train, so many people train well, but you only get one rep in a race.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to recover, have 5 minutes and go again, or you don't get to do 10 reps or 10 400s off a minute, and then by the time you've like got through the first few reps, you start feeling better. Because in a race, you need to be ready, bang. As soon as that gun goes, you get one rep at it. And that's why I think our quality and our perspective on training sort of changed a little bit more, because it is about that one rep. And if you think that you can come back 5 minutes later and do it again, then you've kind of fallen short there.
Mm. Wow. I mean, that was something me and Ollie were going to touch upon. We were going to say, but you're kind of speaking on it now. It was like, you know, John Big, obviously you moved to John Big when 2016 or 2017, was it?
2017. Yeah. 2017.
Yeah. Firstly, to be fair, what kind of made the move for you? Well, you know, why?
I was, so after I had my bike crash, I was coached by James Brewer.
Talk about that a little bit, actually, because I've heard a few things about that. So
mate, James, I'm going to be honest, James is largely the reason why I'm still running now. Cause James, in short, I was on crutches. My head was a mess. I was overweight. My PB was 153. James didn't even know if I was a good athlete, but I think he kind of saw me as a bit of a project, and he massively helped me out and was in the gym with me every day, teach me how to walk again. The walking became the jogging. And James is that portion of my sort of upcoming that sort of put the pieces of the puzzle together. And then we jumped to like a 147 after the bike crash somehow, made British Champs final. And that was a big thing. And then James went off to the States in like the March or the April. Then I joined Matt Yates's group and I trained with Matt from, and then when I joined Matt, we'd done a hell of a lot in the short space of time we worked together, because I joined him in like the March or the April. We'd done like a few training camps, and then he just had like a mindset of like, he just beasts you in training kind of thing. And he was just pushing me really hard in training. And then a few months later, I won British Champs, came third at the Europeans, and then made my first Olympic team. But then it was good while it lasted. But the problem was that I was still getting injuries constantly. So as soon as I came third at Europeans, I had to then spend 2 weeks injured because my Achilles was too bad. And then like months after that, I was constantly just getting like, I was being pushed like to a point where I just constantly was having to navigate injuries, and I was always on the up and down. And then I stopped working with Matt I probably worked with Matt for about 10 to 12 months. So just under a year, I think. And then I moved to John, because our relationship, mine and Matt's relationship, just wasn't, yeah. Long story short, without going into it too much, it didn't really work. And then I ended up with John, and haven't looked back. It took us a few years to figure it out and crack the code, because at first John was trying to give me like the mileage and the run and sort of a conventional training plan. And I was just injured all the time. And then we kind of flipped it on the head and we just figured out what works best for me, which is why I run the little mileage. I do a lot of cross training, and why my training plan is so different to my teammates.
Yeah. Sorry, Lam. I was going to say, do your teammates, are they learning from you? Are they trying to like mirror you, or they kind of stick into what they're already doing?
Yeah. You know what us runners are like, we're all hard-headed. Everyone believes they have the magic solution and they know what they're doing. But it's interesting. I swear by it that I don't think athletes have to run much more than an 8 guy. I don't think needs to run more than 40 mile a week. And I swear by it. I just think you're much better off doing your tempo work, your threshold runs hard, your sessions hard, and then just top. And because I don't see what you gain from doing more than 40 mile a week as an 8 meter runner. I really don't, because all you're doing is putting fatigue in your legs and you're stopping the recovery rate. Whereas if you can get that same stimulus or even work harder on a cross trainer and just boost your cardiovascular system and make your heart rate be able to work at an optimum rate for a longer period of time, I don't see why you have to do that running when you can just do it on the bike, on the cross trainer, in the pool, or any other way. Because, and then you can step up to the track the following day where your calves aren't tight, your quads aren't tight, your glutes are feeling good, your tendons, your neural system's not beat up, and you're ready to go again, and you'll get more quality out of it again. And then when you're feeling beat up from the track, you just jump straight on that cross trainer or whatever it might be, and you're not beating up the body, and your body's able to recover, and you're still able to hit your aerobic system hard. So for me, it's like I beat my body up, then I beat my cardiovascular system up. I beat my body up, and it's like a tit for tat, rather than just beating my body up day in, day out, and just getting injured and ending up flat. Because that's the thing, I'm never ever flat. Like when I train now, I used to always, you know, when you know what it's like when you're training, you just feel completely zonked and you just want to sleep all day, and your body's a mess, your body's not clicking, you're trying to sprint, you can't sprint. And it's I think it's largely down to the weight bearing activities. When you're constantly thudding the ground and your body's just beating itself up all the time, your body sometimes it doesn't recover. And I wasn't recovering personally. It might not be the same for everyone else, but I found that now that I can step up to every session, and I don't walk up to the stairs. I don't walk up the stairs and get lactic anymore. Like my body's always in a better position to go and hit something. I don't get tired all the time. And don't get me wrong, I still have to nap and stuff every now and then, but I'm not as beat up. My calves aren't as tight. My Achilles isn't as bad. My body's just functioning a bit more. And it's largely because of the change in sort of training, if you like.
Yeah. No, that's so interesting. But I think obviously now, like you can look back and you've got so much success doing that. But I guess it takes a lot of confidence going from 2016. You got that European bronze, you make the Olympics. And then obviously if things aren't working with injuries and stuff, but it still, I guess, takes a lot of confidence to say, I'm going to start cross training like that. Cause a lot of people would think you're mad.
Yeah. No, of course. I agree with it, but I kind of step on the start line saying like, I believe that I train harder than a lot of the guys that are doing the higher mileage, because you can't physically run high mileage quick. Mm. Whereas I can cross train like a monster day in, day out, and I won't get injured. So I actually think throughout the winter, I'm probably training harder than a lot of the other guys, because when they do like a 10 mile run, they'll never really run much quicker than 5:40s. Whereas when I'm cross training, I'm gassed out within the first 5 minutes, and then I've still got to go on for another hour and a half or however long it might be. So I'm able to push so much harder, and all it is a question of, do you have the willpower to push through it? Whereas when you're running, it's not really about willpower to a certain extent. You've got to listen to your body. If your body's fucked, you've got to go at that speed. Whereas when you cross train, you can just keep plowing through it pretty much. It's just whether your mind's going to allow you to do it or not.
Mate, so how, if you're like flat out on the cross trainers, how are you still feeling fresh? Because surely you would be, you know, to an extent you would be tired, but you put it down to, you know, because it's non-weight bearing, you just freshen up a lot quicker, basically.
That's it. So then have you ever been on the cross trainer and done like a really hard session?
No.
If you go on the cross trainer and do like a crazy hard session, like you'll be a mess for about 2 minutes afterwards.
Right.
But you'll go and get a shower, you'll go home and you'll feel fine again. You'll be tired. You'll be physically tired, but because you're not beating up your body, like if you get the time and and I actually think because it's non-weight bearing, you can actually physically push yourself harder. Like if you're willing to let your mind go there. So I'm just convinced that you're able to go further, harder and for longer, and not have to deal with the cough cramps, the Achilles pain, the tears, the like the general fatigue. And I don't know, mate, it's a school of thought I've sort of adapted. And I mean, it's obviously not for everyone, because I mean, if it was, the guys in my group would all be doing it. And I try and tell them all the time to come out on the elliptical with me and we'll go and smash the elliptical, and then you can come back and have a good session the following day. But I mean, they just want to run crazy high mileage, and I get it, but I kind of don't get it at the same time.
Do you know what though? That's quite interesting, because I guess I've always thought like swimmers train a crazy amount and they're able to train. Yeah, but you could be not, yeah. And obviously because it's not weight bearing.
That's why they can train twice a day and spend 4 hours in the pool at a time, because their aerobic systems are absolute monsters, and because they're not weight bearing, it's why you could argue that the triathletes are so good at what they do, because it's not all weight bearing and they can train 4 or 5 hours a day because 4 of those hours is probably spent on the bike or in the pool, and it's not physically weight bearing. So they're not overstressing their joints and their bodies and stuff. And then they might do an hour of running. So they're actually probably training closer to the athletes. And it's why some of the triathletes can actually probably out sprint or outrun a lot of our actual traditional runners.
Mm-hmm. No, it's interesting. We've had a couple of guests on the pod. I think Steph Davis and Jake Smith, both of them cross train a hell of a lot, obviously training for the marathon. Would you mind just going through what it looks like kind of in a typical week for you? Because I guess some people listening who might not have heard before are like still trying to get their head around the fact that you run 15, 20 miles a week in the summer.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's largely only that kind of mileage because I race so much. So I don't really have time. I mean, if I'm racing, I'll do like a 2 mile warm up. I'll a couple of strides and then I'll race and then I'll do like an 800 meter warm down. And then before you know it, that's only like 3 to 4 mile max. And then And then if I'm racing once that week, I'll barely do anything that week anyway. But a normal conventional week during the winter or the summer, what would you like to see? Or
summer, please. Yeah.
In the summer, so a Monday would normally be a couple mile warm up. So we normally run Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. So that's our running day. So we cap it to 4 days a week, or 3 days if I'm under high training load. So we'll do Mondays will be a couple of miles, then we'll do a few drills, a couple of strides, and then sometimes we'll do a warm down. Tuesdays will be a normal session, a session day. So we might do we'll do like a couple of mile warm up, and then we'll do our session, which is normally about a mile in volume or so. And then my warm downs are a bit pathetic. I only jog about 800 meters again. And then Thursdays we might do a bit of tempo, and that might be sort of 3 to 4 mile volume at max. And then Saturdays are normally something shorter as well, but because I'm racing so much at the moment, I'm normally missing one of those out, and one of those would just be like a couple mile and a few strides, and then I'm sort of done from there. So it varies, just keeping the body fresher, I guess. And then around that, I'm cross training. So on a Wednesday I'll cross train, on a Friday I'll cross train, and on a Sunday I'll cross train if I'm not having a rest day.
And the importance you put on cross training, I mean, you take your bikes or ellipticals pretty much wherever you go, even when you're traveling to, do you even take it to races sometimes? Or
not races. My elliptical has been out to South Africa. It's been out to Dubai. It goes, when I was in Florida, I got I hired one out there and stuff, and I had someone let me use their elliptical. Mate, I swear by it, I do. I'm convinced that for me personally, and any athlete that deals with injuries, I'm convinced if you can physically get your head around cross training, which is pretty tough, then there's nothing really to stop you from being able to compete.
Do you enjoy it?
Do I enjoy it? If I'm honest, I like running, and if that means that I can run, then don't get me wrong, I could go out for a run.
Yeah, happily do that instead. Yeah.
I don't do it by choice. I do it because it's a means to an end, and it gives me the highs of being able to run consistently without being injured. I used to be injured. I've got a Word document that dates back a few years ago, and there was one point where I was injured 9 months of the year and training 3 months. And it went on like that for years and years. And like, if I'm being honest with you, besides tearing my calf at the start of the season, my quad at the start of the season and spending 3 weeks out, I don't get injured anymore. Like, I haven't had a single injury since I tore my quad in Florida in like one of my last few sessions. Mm. I haven't been injured I was out for like 3 weeks, which was quite tough, and I wasn't able to run. But I just don't get injured anymore. And if I have to cross train to not get injured, I'm cross training every damn day if I have to.
Take it. Mate, do you think injuries are just luck? Or, and you happen to just be more injury prone than like the next guy? Or do you think it's like maybe your mechanics, the way you run is almost like inch perfect with air like on your toes, like driving. And do you think then when you just do more miles, it's just too much stress basically?
Yeah, I think for myself, I would like, so if I was to do a big, so if I done a big tempo on a Thursday, and for instance, when I did my tempo the other day, if I do that and then I try and run the following day, my body's just so beat up that I'll then come to the Saturday and I'll do Saturday session and I become even more tense and more stressed out and my calves are even tighter and my body tightens up. And then before I know it, I get to Monday and I'm injured. And it was just a repeating cycle. Whereas if I take that day off, then my body gets a chance to recover. I'll run the Saturday and then Sunday I've got off again. So I've always, it's almost like day on, day off. The only double days that I do is Mondays and Tuesdays, because that's like race simulation all year round, because I'll do like my warm up, a few drills and stuff, a couple strides, and then I'll jump into the following day and do a bigger session. So that's always sort of almost like race simulation, if you like. And that's probably the only time that I sort of do get a consistent consecutive stress. But besides that, it's kind of just ticking that box.
I mean, how long did it take you to believe in it then? So obviously you would have transitioned into doing a lot more cross training, and then, did you see results pretty quick?
Well, I guess I've always cross trained.
Right.
I guess, what it is? You get to a point where you're so fed up of being injured. You're so fed up of like sitting on the sideline and watching guys run.
Well, most people quit at that point.
Yeah,
people probably quit at that point. Yeah.
Yeah, quitting was never an option. I've never really ever even, not even when I was really down and out, I've never actually considered quitting. I don't think, I'm going to be running until I'm 45. I enjoy running. I mean, I've always said it, like, I'll be running until my legs kind of fall off. I don't care if I'm that guy that used to run 143 and now runs 150. I'm still going to be running, and I'm going to be running because I enjoy it. I enjoy racing. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the process. Like, I'm going to be that guy that is still making British Champs final at a very old I enjoy the race, I enjoy the process. And I'm not afraid to fail either. Like, I don't mind if I'm quite happy, like with the Olympics, I wasn't actually too gutted about it, in the sense that because I knew that I did what I could. I observed like the situation I was in. I saw that there was Rotic, who can kick like an absolute monster. I saw there's Amos, who's renowned in the world for probably being the best kicker in the world. I saw that there's Isaiah Jewett, who likes to front run and is very assertive from the front. I saw that there's Tuukka, who somehow managed to make every single world final sort of year in, year out, and medals at the majority of them. And I remember saying to myself, do you know what? If I was to run this race twice, I wouldn't put myself behind those guys with 200 meters to go. I'm physically the strongest, and I know that I am over 1500. So I ran the race and I thought was the best way to win it. And give me the chance, I'll do it again. And I had the confidence and the belief, and I thought I'd done the training to back it up, and it was just one of them. So I guess that's where the confidence comes. And I know that I'm training as hard as everyone else, so I just kind of sort of roll with it.
Yeah. Talking of that 1500 strength, will we ever see you stepping up, or is it always going to be the eights?
No, I'll be honest with you. Something me and my coach have been discussing quite in detail the last few weeks, few months, in fact, before even the Olympics, because I shouldn't be able to do what I can do off the work I do, because I don't do any 1500 work really. Like my tempos and stuff touch on the kind of speed they might be doing, but their volume will be a lot higher. I don't really do any like longer sessions. We do lots of quality stuff. It's like short stuff and the volume's so small. And I think if I trained for it, see, the problem is that I'm getting to the point in the 800 where I've made such big jumps consistently over the last few years that
yeah,
do I take a curveball, take a swing and try and train for the 15 and risk injury? Or do I continue what I've done this year, take that over to next year? And I think if I do what I've done this year and bring it to next year, I think I make the world final. I do believe that I've got a really strong belief that I'll be in that world final at the bare minimum, and I'll be contending for a medal, and I'll be vying for more than just a medal. But I've built a nice foundation over the last couple of years, and I'm really learning the 8. And do I take the gamble and step up to the 15? Because the 15 is more predictable. You can't, in the most respectful way, you kind of know who's going to be the top five. You kind of know who's going to win. You kind of know who's going to make the final. There's more elements that you can make a mistake. If you make a mistake in the 8 and you get boxed in, if you get boxed in the 8, you've almost said, unless you're head and shoulders above the rest of the pack, like you kind of almost screwed up. Whereas in the 15, you can get boxed in and still find a way out because it's running that much slower. There's more options if you've done the work. But then again, I would be stupid and delusional to think that I'd be able to make it through the rounds having not done the work, because I don't. That's a part of the puzzle that we don't know yet. But we'll see. I don't know. I might have a crack at the 15 for the indoors or something, or just have a little bit of an indoor campaign, because I'll be in the same shape I'm in now indoors pretty much, because I'm not going to change too much going into the winter. I'm still going to train the way I'm training, and I'll be in good shape from the get-go. So we'll see.
And also, I mean, next year you've got what, 3 majors, you know, Euros, commies. So
if I don't walk away with a global medal next year, mate, I'll still be running to 45, but I'll be a sad man. If I don't walk away with a gold somewhere, I'm going to be raging. So we'll start. I mean, the season's not even over yet. I've still got a good 5 or 6 races left this season. And I'm going to give them a good crack, and I'm going to see if I can run some stupid times. But yeah, next year's all about the medals, I think. We'll start with an indoor campaign and take it from there.
Is it world indoors next year? Yeah.
Well, it's a big world indoors, world outdoors, Commonwealths, and Europeans.
Goodness me, man. And mate, do you know your next race then? Will people be able to find out when your next race is?
Yeah, I'm heading out to Pre on Saturday, actually. Sunday, awesome. Sorry. In fact, no, I'm lying. I'm racing Alpham on 1500.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm going to race. If they can get me a decent pace, I'm going to go for the BMC record, I think. Have a good time. I think the record's at 336.
Yeah, Ross Murray, isn't it?
Yeah. So if they can give me a pace, if they can get me a decent pace, I'll have a crack at it and I'll see what I can do. See if the body's willing. And I'm quite happy to just go to the Hurt Locker and see how quickly I can go. I mean, I don't see why not. There's nothing to lose, is there?
Man, that would be insane on home soil as well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in good nick, so there's no reason why I wouldn't have a crack at a quick time by myself. So, but I wouldn't mind if I don't fancy doing 1500 all by myself. I do want to pace it to at least 800, but we'll see what they come out with.
Wow. Well, yeah, if anyone's listening who can run that sort of click, then I'm sure they'll get in touch.
I'm happy. If you can just get me to 800, I'll do the rest.
Wow. 800, what would you want to go through, mate? 157, something like that?
No, quicker than that. I'm a bit delusional with the 15 in the sense that I don't really understand the splits or the times or anything. I don't really know what time I should be running at any point. So I think my theory is that if they just go and run hard and make it sort of a 333, 334 race, I'll go with that. I'm dumb enough to hold on to it. So, and if I die, I die. If I don't, I don't. You kind of never know unless you take a swing, do you?
Good, man. No, you don't, mate. I mean, one last thing I wanted to finish up on as well is you've documented your kind of hobbies outside of running as well. So you just want to let people know like a little bit what you do. Am I right in thinking you put you turn bikes into like e-bikes pretty much?
Yes. So I've got an e-bike business. So I basically give people a budget option. I say budget, the high-end ones are pretty expensive, but yeah. I give people the option to turn a conventional bike into an e-bike. Our Road Eagle ones start about £400, £399. And then I've got the high-end ones, which are like a 2000-watt motor that can do sort of 40 plus mile an hour. That's because I've got a fix for sort of speed and stuff. So that was just a hobby turned to business. And we're actually releasing our own bike range. I'll show you a picture of it now. Actually, I'm quite excited about this.
Wow, mate, it's just a passion of yours, right? You've just learned over time to do all that stuff.
Oh yeah, this is it's a quirky kind of bike, but this is the bike I'll be releasing soon.
Wow.
It's kind of like it's a very niche.
Badass, yeah.
It's a niche kind of style. There we go again.
Yeah.
Hey, what's the company called? What's the bike going to be called?
Going to be, we've liaised with a few factories abroad, and we're going to get them custom built. So that's just a base model of what we use, and then we're going to customize it. So we're going to be entering the bike market very soon. And like with everything, it's capital and learning how all this works and learning how business works, and then getting around all the fine details like anti-dumping tax and all the rest of it, and then figuring out your customer base and sorting out Google Ads, SEO, and it's an absolute minefield, but it keeps me busy. And yeah, we've started off with the e-bike kits. We've done really well with that. In fact, we've had no stock for the last 3.5 months because we sold out, and we've got a waiting list of like 60 or 70 people at the moment. And as soon as our new kits arrive, hopefully they'll sell out within a few weeks. And then we've got that dilemma of having no kits again for a few months. And we're just trying to basically, in short, build our money up so that we can have like in stock 200 to 300 kits. At the moment, we can only sort of afford to stock sort of up to 50 kits at a time. But the problem is we're selling out of them so quickly.
You're going to need to be stocking more. Yeah. Cause you've got a waiting list of Jesus Christ, man.
And then the problem is we don't want to take too, we want to take investment, but we want to get to a point where we can actually justify a large investment. We don't want to give away a large part of the company for very little money when we know that in 12 months' time, if we looked for that same investment, because we're growing so quickly and selling so much, we kind of want to get to a point where we can ask for a bigger chunk of money, have that person invest, and then we can capitalize the niche e-bike market. We're not trying to compete with like that bike I've just showed you. We're not trying to compete with your Specialized, your Trek, your Giant. We want to be like the quirky brand. We're going to release some, there's that model there, and then there's two other models that we're going to release, and they're just proper cool, edgy bikes that we're going to bring to the market. And
hey, I can see them now just all zipping around London. Looks the part as well.
Yeah, so. I've just ordered a sample kit. If it's good, the quality is good, if I'm happy with everything, I'm going to put down an order for between 20 and 50. It all depends on how much money I can earn over the next few races, put it that way. Depending on what I earn over the next few races and stuff, if I earn anything, if I even have a bloody contract at the end of the year and all the small things, I'm basically just trying to set myself up, because I've got like a kid on the way and stuff now. And trying to put myself in a position where I'm not reliant on the running, which is why I'm hoping to be in a position to continue running for as long as I want, because I'm not reliant on making a living from it. So if the e-bikes work, I'll invest what I can into it. I'll take a swing. If it fails, then at least I've tried and I'll have learned enough skills to do the next thing. But the worst thing I can do is not try and then end up bloody stuck out of a contract and all the rest of it. So
sorry for yourself. Mate, I think a lot of athletes could learn from that mentality and learn, you know, to try and source income from, you know, not just contracts, because as we know, you know, contracts are not everything in athletics right now.
Oh, mate, you need to be sourcing your income before you, even if you got the contract, you need to be sourcing your income now or planning ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I sign a contract and it's 2 or 3 years or 4 years or however long or short it is, I won't stop doing the e-bikes. I need to get myself in a position where I can afford to live off the e-bikes alone and the contracts. Or if you even have a contract and if you earn a bit of money from racing itself, you can't rely on sport, man. It's too unpredictable. You have one injury and you're done.
Yeah. And I think when you're relying on contracts, you know, you've just got so much added stress, haven't you?
Oh, mate. The thing is, like, this is a difficult thing. Like, a lot of guys step on that start line for British champs, and if they don't make the team, they get reductions in their contracts. They have this problem to deal with. And they just end up in like a spiral of like depression and all the rest of it. And if they don't make finals and all, that's why I'm not in the mindset. Like, for me, I just say, like, if I make the team, great. If I don't, I don't. But if I'm going to damn sure make it hard for you to beat me. And as long as I know that I'm going to bust my balls and make you sort of sweat to beat me, then I've kind of done my job. That's why these younger guys, I mean, I'm 27 now. These guys are 19. I'm planning on kicking their ass for a good 6 or 7 years. So we'll see what happens.
They're not going to enjoy listening to this, mate.
No, I'd be, if they even listen to it, but I'll be around for a good long time. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. And I'm hungry and I'm young enough and I'm dumb enough to keep trying. So we'll see.
Yeah, well, are we going to see any more YouTube coming soon? Because obviously you've had a little bit on there with the bikes and the cross training, but I think a lot of people would love to see it.
I'm going to be honest with you, mate. I've got my hands in too many baskets. I want to push it. Mm. I do want to push it, but I'm trying to do, I spend so much time on the e-bikes and now like I've got a little one on the way. I'd love to push it, but I don't know. I don't know if there's an audience like that want to see it, if that makes any sense. And if there is an audience that want to see it, I would push it more, but yeah, there's not, I guess I need to put out at least 10 videos before I get to that point. I've only put out 2 so far. So
now your teasers have been pretty good, you know?
Yeah.
You make the content yourself?
I have someone. I'm of the opinion that if you're going to do something, do it properly. So I've got a guy that I pay to do it for me. But again, I can't afford to keep releasing that content because it costs so much. And then I'm not willing to release subpar content. If I'm going to release it, it's the good stuff. But then I guess I really should probably aim for consistency and probably get a lower grade of quality and stuff. But we'll see, man. I got to my hands in too many pies at the moment.
Yeah, no, I think just keep doing what you're doing, mate. It's working. Yeah. It's going to be exciting to watch you, you know, keep progressing, basically, even though you're already at an incredible high level, you know, to keep progressing.
Yeah.
But, mate, cheers for coming on. It's been an absolute brilliant podcast. I mean, Lum, that's been one of my favourites by far, right?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much, man. It's good to hear. I think your mindset on kind of how you approach races and championships just really came across. And I think people were so interested to listen to it.
Yeah, I swear by it. Racing doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be stressful. It doesn't have to be anything more than you need it to be. Just run, man. You run every day. If you don't ever, it was funny. I spoke to some of the guys on the team. And I just said, if you don't ever train bad, there's no reason to ever to race bad. And that's the way I view it. There's absolutely, so you shouldn't ever really have a bad run. If you don't ever train bad, the only reason that's stopping you is something in there. And you just, you need to figure that out one way or another. If you're an athlete that struggles with that, just chill out. It's training, it's racing. Racing's the fun part. It's the easy part. It's 1 or 2 laps or 4 laps or 5K, whatever you do. Training's way harder than that. Training, you have to bust your balls and actually really question your character. Racing, you just have to freshen up and put one leg in front of the other and beat the guy next to you.
Bloody hell, mate. You've inspired me.
It's simple, yeah.
Give me on the cross train later, Matt.
Yeah. But to take it with a pinch of salt, I still haven't won a world medal yet. So we'll see.
We'll see. Yeah, I think there's one coming.
Yeah, we'll see.
Dying for years ahead. Well, look, yeah. Thanks very much for coming on, mate.
Pleasure, lads.
Thanks for listening, guys. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode. As always, if you did, please leave us a rating and review on your preferred podcast streaming service, as it really helps us out. For next week's pod, we've got a really exciting guest for you again. We've got Lizzie Burr, the steeplechaser. She's also just back from Tokyo, like Giles, and where she ran another British record. So look out for that and see you next week, guys.